Thank you, Chris. All right, friends, I've typed his last question there in the chat, and you are going to be randomly assigned to a group of three or four folks by the algorithm to toss this question around for about 15 minutes or so, maybe about 20, depending. And then we'll come back and do a little bit of Q&R and dialogue with Chris, and we'll be on our way around 11:30-ish. So you're going to need to accept this invitation when it comes, and please join your breakout room conversation to toss around his last question. So we've got about 15 minutes or so to have a little bit of dialogue with Chris. And so if you have a question, you can do the digital raise hand feature by clicking participants raise hand. You can try to get our attention, although there's multiple windows open, it's hard to see you, or you can just type something in the chat. And in fact, to begin, we've got a question in the chat already. So this question comes from Maura Chris. And it says, could you speak to the role of religion and churches as a necessary leadership voice for this confronting racism issue vis-a-vis your grandfather's work that came out of the institution of politics? She says that she's also asking this as so many Americans that she knows have left their religious congregations over the past few decades. Thank you.
That's, I think, a hard question to answer. I think it's hard because churches in the country are one of the most segregated institutions. And so I don't think there's one answer that can apply to that overall. I often tell people that if you want to experience not only the most authentic expression of Christianity, but I think also the best that Christianity has to offer the world, you will see it at Black churches and churches that are committed to liberation theology, primarily in Mexico and South America. And those expressions are so insanely different than our understanding of Christianity as white people. And so I think some of that is to learn from Black churches and churches committed to liberation theology more, delve into that, experience it, understand the theology, the driving force behind it. The other aspect is that for white churches especially, there's a tremendous amount of power in white churches, and just simply changing the structure of white church could be monumental. But even white churches are so diverse. You know, my church is mainline Protestant. I tell people it's liberal because we take a contextual approach to the Bible because we're an inclusive church. But the theological differences between evangelical churches and mainline churches the chasm between it is so stark that I'm not really sure. I think it's a matter of what I had you guys talk about right now is to say that, what do you have power of over in your circumstances and your context? What is your church makeup? What can you do to address the theology of your churches? My grandfather, a congressman in San Bernardino, a congressman in a majority Latinx population, grew up right next to the Mexico border, spent his entire childhood playing with migrant children. I'm sure some of you read about the SUV that crashed that was hit by a semi, 13 people they've confirmed dead. That was in the town that my grandfather grew up in. And so I think for him, it came with very much a personal relationship with the people that he was trying to help. He had a lot of trust with that community because he spent majority of his life with the folks he was helping and developing those relationships. And that's a lifelong work. In my work as a white pastor in my community, the largest community of color here is Latinx, a lot of migrant workers as well. And frankly, there's just so much distrust between the Latinx community and white churches that it's almost not bridgeable. And so, I think what we've done here at Bethania is to just simply offer our space. This is what we started before the pandemic hit. We reached out to some folks and just said, look, we don't have a ton of money, but we have this giant property. And so come use it. And we had a folklorico group that started a few weeks before the pandemic hit, and we were going to start a space for kind of a cultural expressions of invite the Latinx community to come and use the space how they wanted. And it was basically gonna be no holds, you know, just however you guys want to use it that way. And you know, if a relationship develops from that, that would be phenomenal. But if not, that's a way we can use our property and our structure to help out. So I don't know if I answered that question fully. I don't know if I can answer that question fully, but I hope that was okay.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I see Jackie Reed's got a hand up.
Yes, I would like to start with a little story and then add with a question. It's not really a story, but like hundreds of years ago when I applied for college, on the application, there was the word race. And I put down human and sent it in. And it was sent back to me that they could not process it until I accurately answered that question. I would like, and as I understand it and see it, that is on so many applications still to this day, race. Why can't we just forget about that word and people just be people? Who cares what your race is? We are humans, we're human beings. Let's stick with that one big general category. No, I'm not a baboon, I'm a human being. Isn't that enough?
Yeah, so that your question was included in that, right? Why can't we just stick to the human race?
How can we get people to stop putting that on applications for jobs, for schools, for almost anything you want to do, for taking courses, taking classes in adult ed, which I did, there was that race question again.
Yeah. So it's really important to understand that, like you said, race is a construct. Our race is the Homo sapien race. Anthropologically speaking, that's the truth. But race is a construct that came out along the times that Africans started being sold into slavery. It parallels this. And I hesitate to reference this book because there's some backlash, but Robin DiAngelo addresses this in White Fragility. And this is a white woman who made a lot of money after George Floyd's death and selling her book, White Fragility. But she does address this. And that's to say that the construct of race happened at the same exact time that Africans started being sold into slavery. And race needed to be created as a construct to justify the abhorrent system of slavery. And race is going to remain a construct as long as there is systemic inequality happening in our country. I mean, if we changed it from using or asking a person's race to asking what their ethnic background is, it's not going to change the fact that we still have systemic inequality based on race in our entire world. And so I think part of the answer there, and this is where a lot of white folks tend to split here. You cannot address racism without addressing economics. That is so important to understand. So until you address economics and economic inequality and wealth inequality, you're going to have to deal with the construct of race at the same time. Part of the reason that they ask a person's race on college applications is because colleges are still so, so deeply engaged in racial inequality as to the students that get in to colleges. And so in a way, it's important to be able to quantify that and to see it in front of our faces and to see that inequality. But until colleges just naturally reflect the diversity of our communities, it's probably going to be an important reason to see who's being accepted into colleges and who isn't.
Well, I think that's my point, is until we stop needing that, we're not going to change.
Yeah, so the work there is not to just simply start calling everybody the human race, but to address the issues that that have necessitated us dividing people into race.
All right, another question from Molly is, have you examined the history and role of non-Jews fighting anti-Semitism? Perhaps can be seen an earlier form of anti-racist movement and commitment.
I haven't examined it a whole lot. I would probably say it's along the same line of work, though. And I think that non-Jewish people who are committed to the work of anti-Semitism fall to the same issues that they do with anti-racism. And that's being largely ignorant of the experience of Jewish people and how we as a society still perpetrate anti-Semitism And so I would say the work is quite similar as that of anti-racism work.
And let's see here. Cindy asks, first says, thank you so much, and says, can you speak to the rural and urban divide as part of this anti-racist work?
Oh gosh. I mean, the rural and Kendi talks about this quite a bit too, but the rural and urban is again, it's a it's economics, it's redlining, it's gentrification, it's Black people fleeing the rural South to urban centers because of the tremendous racism and danger they were experiencing, and then getting into those areas and being redlined and gentrified, and so white flight occurring to create suburbs, which are white supremacy. Rural communities are now largely populated or controlled by white populations as communities of color have tried to go back to rural parts to work, to farm, et cetera. They've been prevented tremendously from doing so. I think the question of the disparity between rural and urban communities is also the question again of economics, and just the tremendous amount of effort that has been put into keeping Black people impoverished and contained in certain areas. So, I mean, gosh, if you want to look at the whole scope of racism, and I think anti-racism in an example that kind of captures all of it, I think that movement from rural to urban and the prevention from urban back to rural is a big place to look at.
And there's another question in the chat asking if you could define Latinx and cishet. And Karen also sent a helpful link in the description for cishet. But if you can speak to that, Chris, yeah. I think some people are wondering.
Yeah, good questions. Latinx, you know, so in the Spanish language, as in, you know, Greek and Hebrew and Latin, a lot of the words are genderized into male and female. Only it's, you know, it's a binary. And so people within the Latinx community have started using Latinx to remove the genderization of that word, so that it not only, I mean, because it's typically Latino, that's a patriarchal way of saying it. The default there is to go to the male conjugation of that word. And so it's members of the Latinx community have replaced the O with an X, not only to address the patriarchy within that system, but also the binary gender as well, that it's not just male and female, but that there's non-conforming members of the Latinx community as well. And I'll also say, as white people, we do a tremendous service. This is one of those tangible things that you can do, is to start saying Latinx instead of Latino. It's a way of showing support for our Latinx siblings out there. And it's good to use that and have people ask, why are you saying Latinx? And then you can have a conversation with them. Cisgenders is a way to be more specific with transgendered folks. You know, for a long time, the work of inclusion with lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender folks has kind of been lumped under the umbrella of LGBT. But as time has gone on, become quite apparent that transgender folks experience a lot of discrimination, even from the lesbian and gay and bisexual community. And that the experience of transgender people, while they're kind of included in the umbrella of LGBTQ, really is it's not a unique experience, but it's an experience that kind of deserves its own space of being discussed and being confronted. And so recently people have started to delineate between transgender and cisgender. And to say cisgender just means that you are the gender or the sex that you were assigned at birth. So I am a cisgender person. I consider myself a male. I was assigned male at birth, and so I am a cisgender person, as opposed to someone who's transgender, who is assigned a sex at birth that they do not identify with.
And again, Karen's also posted something else in the chat that's helpful in case you want a link to further explore Chris's brief explanations. Thank you so much. All right, friends, I think we are at time this morning, and I'm going to toss it back over to Mary Ann to close us out and send us on our way.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Wow. Thank you, Chris, for a provocative, heartfelt, I would say challenge for us as white people to go deeper into our role. I know that there's a lot of food for thought there with me. What stands out is the role of the hero. Wow. You know, to examine how we as white people go about this work with anti-racism. But thank you for your heart, your presence, and your courage in the work that you're doing. I know it will continue, and I'm just very grateful to that. So I'm going to sort of send us out with another short little quote from Howard Thurman. There is a quiet courage that comes from an inward spring of confidence in the meaning and significance of life. There is something in every one of you that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself.